What does America's energy future look like? For many, we're on a path to a smart, efficient system, much less dependent on carbon, and thereby cleaner and more affordable. Renewable energy accounted for nearly two-thirds of new power sources on the U.S. electric grid in 2016, but it's early yet. Those new sources accounted for only about 6% of the power used. As energy development differs from place to place, we might benefit from a perspective closer to home. We'll talk to some key Marquette Board of Light and Power officials about the changing energy industry, new Upper Peninsula generation, planning, and related topics next on Media Meet. Hello and welcome to WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guests are from Marquette's Board of Light and Power. They are Executive Director Paul Kitty, Engineering Consultant John Reynolds, and Board Member Jerry Irby. Joining me on the panel is Mining Journal Staff Writer Mary Wardell. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin with a very general question directed to Paul here. You've decided to retire this summer after a long career in the energy sector. Congratulations.
Thank you.
20 years with the UP Power Company and Wisconsin Public Service, then 13 years with the Marquette Board of Light and Power. How generally do you view America's energy landscape? What stands out for you and what seems to lie ahead, especially for communities like ours?
First of all, on behalf of our board, our employees and the whole community, I want to thank Northern and everybody for the gracious invitation to talk a little bit about the energy future here. As we look at it in our region and everything else, it's an honor and a privilege to be here. And with respect to the landscape, one word, wow. It's changing fast. It's changing fast. Choice and change, two constants for the future, moving along. And as we look at our new units being dual fuel, we look at the main fuel going to be natural gas. And that right there, in one word, gas is becoming king.
Okay.
Gas is king right now. There's an abundant supply of it. The prices are very stable. There's a lot of regulatory things that are presenting challenges to coal. So we see the environment changing a lot in that landscape. And infrastructure is changing. New load-serving entities are being built. Transmission solutions are being contemplated. The state's got a very active plan involved in changing the landscape and how we deliver reliable, safe energy. Because the consumers throughout Michigan, from Copper Harbor to Detroit, when they pay their bill, they pay for reliability. That's
sure.
Really what they're doing.
John, so much of this is tied into new technology and science. You must see a lot of interesting stuff out there.
Yes, as Paul mentioned, everything is transitioning now. So I'm an old coal guy, and we're seeing coal slowly fade away, especially sure. Some of the older coal units. So we're transitioning into gas, newer technologies. We're moving into more renewables. The BLP is well positioned now with this new gas generation units that will have coal, gas, hydro, and solar. We're putting in that solar farm. So, okay. Yeah, it's an exciting industry at this time, but a lot of change, a lot of hand wringing in some places.
I'll bet. Jerry, you're the new guy, not for public service, but in terms of the energy sector here. What are you seeing?
Well, as Paul mentioned, proactive instead of reactive. Over 2-3 years ago, the board decided they were going to look into a new approach to energy, again, the clean energy, the natural gas, and did their research, hired their consultants, went out and got their bids from different suppliers of engines, reciprocating engines, if you will, and the decision was good. We're in the process of, within a month or two away of starting up our new energy platform, Marquette Energy System, and the as John mentioned, coal Michigan right now is in a, I think, a quandary. You know, they're shutting down 25 coal power plants downstate, below the bridge.
Mm-hmm,
okay?
Across the state.
And we've had plants up here that have gone away, Escanaba, you know, different ones that had to close down. And, you know, the Marquette Board of Light and Power has now taken the position with our new system to take us into the, you know, the next 10, 20, 30 years. And the reliability, sustainability, dependability are the three factors, and we've got those cooking. We got those, you know, that's happening. Sure, the rates went up a little bit, but you have to pay for the, you know, the infrastructure. You have to pay to, you know, get the engines there.
Sure.
Now we're in a position to start growing with our customers, providing them those energies that they need. Creating jobs, Bill. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping down the road there's somebody that's going to say we're going to go to Marquette. They got great air, they got water, they got a great community to live in, they got energy to support our industry. Those are things of the future that we look for.
Okay.
Do you see any regulatory changes coming down the pike from the new administration that might change the outlook on coal or any of these other?
Well, you know, there's always change. Okay, as long as it's good for the future. And as far as the regulatory, there's been some real strong restraints against coal. I think coal has its place in our industry. It's a matter of, you know, how that coal is handled, you know, the clean coal, so to speak. I think the EPA needs to back off a little bit. I think they need to look at a future. I think, Paul, you mentioned Palisades closing. That's a nuclear plant. Now, they've been around for a while. You know, to get a nuclear plant up and running, by God, you need, what, 10 or 15 years of regulatory issues that you have to go through. Is that part of our future also? We don't know. It's going to be interesting, Mary, to see what comes out of new rules, new regulations.
Okay. For those who are outside the immediate area, Jerry was mentioning the Marquette Energy Center, which is a municipal upgrade due to be completed in June of 2017. You say you're a little ahead of schedule, maybe?
Yeah, but my sense is right now the project is about 92% complete.
Okay.
The civil, mechanical, electrical are moving along. Civil's behind us right now. Mechanical, electrical is being tied in right now. Every once in a while, if you get a little speed bump and hurdles, it's like trying to pick out a good used car. You
know,
you want to check the brakes, you want to make sure the transmission is good.
Kick tires.
And that kick and the fuel pump.
Yeah.
So we're looking at this. We've got gas infrastructure all established. We've just got to turn that valve now. But there's a commissioning process that's going to be happening. So 100% of the engineering is complete right now. I'm going to give a shout out to the trades.
Okay.
About 25 companies, contracts working on site. I'm going to say on a daily basis, 125 employees. A lot of them tradespeople from the UP.
Great.
Good work. They're doing great work. I said this before. I'd put these workers up against anybody in the world. In fact, one of our Finnish colleagues came in and he says, I don't understand this. He says, if ever else I go, there's three workers for every one you have here. And that's kind of the work ethic. They're self-directed. They're doing well. So we're on track. We anticipate first smoke, and our first smoke is like mid to late May, where we start testing the engines. We have to test them for KW megawatt output. We got to do overspeed tests on them, safety brake tests. We have to check all the thousands of systems in there because everything's tied into our master control room in the through the motor control center in our. Electrical building. So there's a lot of tests. So there's going to be a process of commissioning that will take it steps it away. They're going to run it at 20% load, bring it down, test for emissions, run it at 40% load, bring it down, do all the tests. So they have to do this for all the units. So there's a delicate protocol that will take place. And then we will not accept the final test until everything checks out there. Because then after that point, we bring it to commercial operation. Now, in our sense, we've always said June of 2017. Mm. My sense is June 1, probably can't pick that as a date.
I see.
But maybe June 17th, the 22nd or something, we're gonna be very close. So there's some evolutions, and we have got a great team locally here. Sergeant Lundy's got a great team. Vartsala's got a great team. Miron General Contractors, they're working well. We're working with the Department of Environmental Quality for some other permitting things and stuff like that. So we've got a team that we're pulling everybody together. And as, again, one of the great Finnish colleagues said, he says, we come here, nobody hollering. Because if you holler, you get excited, things do not get done.
Okay.
We keep our eye on the prize and try to keep the peripheral issues off to the side and keep focus. Focus on the problem. So, yeah. Great teamwork here.
Okay. Ed, I want to get some issues here. Go ahead, Jerry. Okay,
just a quick anecdote. When I was on the shore when they brought the engines on shore, mm-hmm. By barge, by water, you know, by boat from, you know, it just Escanaba here, what have you. When the first engine came on shore, there was probably 200-300 people standing around watching it. They started to clap and cheer. I mean, they were waiting for this.
Sure.
You know, we knew we had a winner here. The people were behind it. And, you know, just to see those big engines come on shore from the Lake Superior waters was fantastic.
Big win.
I wanted to ask a little about the budget, because it's a $65 million project. And it seems like you guys have been right on budget, and you even have some left over in a contingency fund.
Mm-hmm.
Is the status of that still pretty positive? Or?
Yes, we're tracking very well with that right now, better than anybody expected, I think. So we're not done yet, but we're hopeful that we're going to come in, you know, well below budget.
Yeah, there's so many things that couldn't be anticipated, you know, in a refined
like this,
way.
Mm-hmm. There are literally 1,000 moving parts.
Yeah,
and not everything always works out. It's the Christmas present under the tree, you slid the wrong one to the wrong child, you know.
Okay.
It's not a perfect plan, but we make adjustments, so mm-hmm. we adapt, and we overcome.
Okay. The big issues appear to be, from all the planners I've talked to for at the state level and other places, reliability, affordability, and clean energy, or environmentally responsible energy, are big issues. And I understand reliability was a major factor for the BLP in making the decision to go to something new, because you were about to lose access to the large transmission grid supporting Marquette's electrical demand. Is that a common challenge these days? Are you seeing plants being so outdated that they can't actually supply the general system?
Yeah, in our position, we're kind of unique because we're at the end of the long transmission line, grid. Now, other communities, they have maybe 2 transmission lines or 3 or even 4. So we're not blessed with that. So we have to make do up here to take care of our own communities. So the way we do that is we add generation. We make sure we have reliable generation. Now, you know, with phasing out of coal and our aging units, and we lost that transmission ability, that firm power, we moved into these units for reliability. Because in the middle of January, we can't lose power up here.
Yeah, you can't.
For
example. Turn the switch and nothing happened. Go ahead.
If I could add to this, a few years ago, I think we all remember the Dead River flood. Okay, we were out for 30 days, the mines were down, the economy of the county was just tanking.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a meeting that I happened to be in an office at that time, and the meeting was with the power company. We had a power company that said, no, you're at the end of the grid. We don't want to supply the power to you. We want to take it down to Wisconsin. We got customers down here that need it. We had to fight to get power. We had to actually open up generation systems in Ontonagon to get enough power to start our mines up. That, to me, was a big story, because it's reliable power. We can't afford to be down for 30 days. We can't afford to be down for a day. And I think our new units are, is it right, Paul, five minutes that they're up and running. If we need them running, five minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're pushing full load in 5 minutes, and we're pushing megawatts that are grid in 2 minutes. Where, if you look at the older technology, coal, with either a stoke or a pulverized units, where you're blowing the crushed coal into the boiler.
Yeah.
You're talking an 8 to 12 hour ramp time, startup time there, by the time you get a fire in the boiler, that suspended flame in there to superheat the pipes.
Okay. The just a reminder to our viewing audience, especially our radio listeners, that we're getting some observations on energy from BLP Executive Director Paul Kitty, Engineering Consultant John Reynolds, and Board Member Jerry Irby. The issue of remaining compatible with the grid has been something that's been looked at a lot across the country. A smart grid can be more efficient, but at the same time, it becomes vulnerable then to cyber mischief, and that's just coming to light. Do you see operational security as an issue across the system?
Yeah, that's a big issue. If someone were to get into the grid system and open circuit breakers, so people would lose power, cities would lose power, of course, it would be a disaster. So as far as the border latent power, our systems that are mission critical, operational critical, we are disconnected from the internet. So if we have, say, a OEM that wants to come in and look at and do maintenance on a system, we plug in a line. So it's a hard connection.
I see.
That we prevent any hacking or anything
right, like
that.
Yeah. That makes sense. Michigan wants more renewables in its portfolio. We're told that wind is the quickest way there for the Midwest. Everyone is intrigued by solar, of course. Some private utilities are planning for inclusion of renewables, and even corporations are starting to look at it. Do you see large-scale demand shifting anytime soon? You said gas is probably going to be with us for a long time.
I mentioned, and I'll repeat that, gas is king right now.
All right.
Coal is shifting. You're going to see more renewables coming in there, and they have their place in that. But there's one observation I had mentioned before, prior to getting on the set, is no matter what we do and how we provide load-serving entities to push the electrons on the grid out there, every community will need every house, virtually every house, hooked up to a service drop. You'll need transformers, you're gonna need conductor, you're gonna need poles, you're gonna need recloser banks, the three-phase recloser banks and that. That's heavily capital intensive. So that part of our industry, our distribution out there, is gonna remain. And that'll always be a part of any community, any utility's rate base, is that cost of service. Because people, if they want wind or solar like that, just say, I want it, I want to save money, I'm going to disconnect. But two facts, the sun rises once a day and it sets once a day.
Yeah.
And in between, there's no power there. So you will always need this. And I'll use for an example, Duke Life Point. They're going to be a major load, about 5 megawatts. We're going to provide multiple circuits feeding them for redundancy and reliability, because they're going to have a $300 million operation and they can't afford to lose power. And we don't want them to lose power,
right?
Because when you're in the OR, we don't want any blinks.
Understand.
So we're going to, so we have this. So there's a place for it. How it displaces a lot of load down the road, my sense is, these Wärtsilä units are going to be able to chase renewables because, as you mentioned before, the ramp time, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Coal cannot chase the renewables. So I see the shifting sands there a little bit.
I see. Okay. Mary?
I was curious how the some of the environmental concerns play into coal and gas. I know coal is much cleaner. Is that something that individual utilities think about, or is that more on the regulatory end? And is that something you anticipate to be an issue with gas? Or
right now we obtained a clean air permit for our gas units very rapidly. We thought it would take months. We got it very quick from the DEQ. So these are easily permitted because they are clean technology. If you were to build a coal plant today, I think it would take a number of years to get a permit, if you could get one.
Sure. Yeah. We were talking about the barriers to solar and the costs that are incurred that are going to have to be included in any change. But the Residential solar development is being restrained in some states right now. The financial incentives for consumer solar are being dropped in some states. This includes net metering, which allows consumers to sell back excess generation. Now, Michigan has capped this at 1%. Some states are beginning to undo net metering altogether. What's happening, and what does it say about the energy industry and the markets?
When you talk about solar, we are approaching it with the Marquette Board of Light and Power. We have a solar farm right now that is being constructed. I believe the last meeting we okayed all the contracts for that. We're moving forward with around close to 500 panels that will be there located by the Board of Light and Power. Our customers will be able to buy panels.
Right.
They might not be able to put them on their roof, but they're going to have it in our solar farm. We're going
sure.
to provide them the energy and give them credits back. Net metering takes place there. It's the start of the discussion in the community at a higher level of solar. And we're hoping that it's going to be a wave of the future. But as was talked about, you have to have a system to back up your solar in your home. We're giving them the system in the BOP that we will provide
right.
to where they don't have to make
but the bulk of the cost is being handled by the consumer, right?
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You
well,
provide a site,
panels,
you provide some support.
We're going to provide the site. We're going to provide the maintenance on there, too. We didn't build that into the rates there.
Does that result in a significant savings for the people who buy the panels? That's the question.
Yeah, going back a little bit before that, we're going to a distributed resource rate. It's a little change from net metering because this way, if you want to put in, say, some solar panels, you're not going to be subsidized by the customers that don't want to put solar panels in or wind or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it's what all the industry is moving towards right now. They're moving away.
Isn't that called net energy metering or something like that instead of net metering?
Yes, it's a change. So the industry discovered that they're subsidizing some of the renewables and people didn't want to do that.
I see.
So they are moving to that.
What's been the public reception with the solar garden? Is there any chance or opportunity for that to expand in the future? Or
we have right now, I believe, all the panels sold. We've had people signing up left and right, so you know they're committed to the concept. They want to be involved with solar. They can't afford to put on their roof. They can afford to maybe buy one or two or three, four panels in the solar farm, and then have a feeling that you know I'm helping the environment, but I'm also helping myself with credits back to my bill.
Yeah, it's even been suggested by some solar advocates that they would forgo net metering in favor of providing excess energy at no charge to low-income people. Has anyone heard of that being done anywhere?
Yeah, you know, we have not seen interest on our system for that, but if we did see interest, we definitely would look at how we could move towards that.
Okay. In an interview, Paul, you said the BLP has done a lot of re-engineering to keep the utility viable, and you also mentioned, I thought this was intriguing, you said you've even re-engineered jobs to keep people employed. I know the relationship with the union seems pretty solid. The evolution in manufacturing technology helped reduce the workforce. Did you see utility jobs remaining secure as the systems begin to evolve here?
Utility jobs in America are going to be very secure.
Okay.
Now, if there's a one size fits all, like in a coal plant where somebody does not want to be retrained or start adapting at other coal plants where they start moving away from that, that'll present some challenges. We've had a series of retirements where we haven't replaced it.
Okay.
We've modified our workforce. We've really down 12 to 15% in the recent years.
Mm-hmm.
We've adjusted. We've got a very good working relationship with our union. Rich Johnson and his colleagues, his constituents, understand that we have to work together to solve this problem.
Yeah.
And we've always said, and I've said as an executive director, we're going to go through this process. And unless you don't want to man a broom or something or patrol a line or do some brushing and that, you'll have work. If you don't want to do that, then maybe I don't have work for you. So we've been very upfront with them, and nobody's going to lose their job with this.
Okay.
But they're going to be asked to do different things. And as we have a job vacancy, what we do is we panel with a number of us. We sit down, even with the union, we say, okay, what does this job look like? Well, this couple things were in here back in 79 or 86 when it was posted, that can fall by the wayside. Okay. What are some of the things we can put back into that job? So we add some things to it. So we build the job up a little bit. On the surface, they say, wow, that's more than 40 hours a week. We say, get comfortable. Yeah. You'll get through it. You'll get through it. So we make some adjustments, like we're doing in warehousing, in the storehouse. We got some people doing collateral water testing duties down at our power plant.
Okay.
There'll be people doing other things. We've trained a lot of our metering technicians when we went away from meter reading.
Yeah.
We've trained them into being bird dogs when lines are down. And it was a good example is when we had our streetlight person retired some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a rite of passage that let's just move the next person up there. And I said, well, let's do a timeout. Let's look at a journeyman line person, a line mechanic, journeyman lineman.
Okay.
Put him in that position. So when we do have a storm or an outage, I take that journeyman lineman out of that streetlight position, and they're doing mistakes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I can put a couple master electricians with them and a supervisor, and I basically come up with almost another crew for this. So in the recent storm that we had, all of Michigan was catastrophically out. We had a lot of service restoration done real quick. We had 5 crews out there. Some years ago, we might have had 3.
I see.
So we've done some different things, and we've moved some people that were in the metering department into apprenticeship line electrician programs. So like the Marines, adjust, adapt, and overcome. We're just kind of moving along here. So you do things, you get input from a lot of different sources, and the more sources that you gather input from, the better the outcome, the decision. So we've done that, and consequently, nobody's lost their jobs. Some people are a little bit busier than they have been in the past,
yeah.
But that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing, because we always say we're still playing with grandma's money.
Right.
How does that compare with the wider industry? Is that kind of the same approach being taken across the board?
That's a very good question. Very good question. With respect to other industries, there's actually 3 models out there. I'll mention these 2 business models.
Okay.
There's an investor-owned business model.
30 seconds. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
There's an investor-owned business model, which I worked for a number of years, and a not-for-profit business model. We operate 2 different ways. We drive value for our customers every day. Not saying they don't drive value, but they drive shareholder value. So we look at things a lot differently. We look at things when we're moving with contracts, we bid most of those things out. We want competitive bidding. When we bid out our fuel, 8 fuel suppliers came in for filling up our fuel depot.
Mm-hmm.
We chose one, saved the BLP a lot of money. Save the consumers a lot of money.
The community.
So,
right.
so we have a different business model. So, my sense is that they look at things a little bit different as they drive shareholder value. I would look at that a little bit differently too. But so it's 2 different business models. So, I can't without another program like this. I can't get into the weeds like that. But it would be a good discussion for those people that you, Merck, or Detroit Edison or our principal power company to talk about how they manage their process.
Okay, we're gonna have to leave it there for time. We've been getting observations on America's energy landscape from Marquette Board of Light and Power Executive Director Paul Kitty, engineering consultant John Reynolds, and board member Jerry Irby. Thank you for being here. With me on the panel has been Mining Journal staff writer Mary Wardell. I'm Bill Hart. Thanks for joining us on Media Meet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.